Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this Tuesday Speak Up, July 15th. Hope you're all doing well this morning. And for today's Speak Up, we've got a good mix of talk, but a little bit of music coming your way soon as well. I'm going to be playing some pieces off of Frequency News that I think are worth hearing. But I'm also going to be discussing an event that I went to very recently, and by very recently, I mean last night. It was a community discussion about the public transit changes that are currently slated for the Marpole area in Vancouver. And even though, you know, this is quite an insular topic of discussion, I do think it sort of acts as a bit of a microcosm and, you know, is representative of, I guess, larger transit discussions that are happening throughout the Lower Mainland and the province in general. So I thought I would speak on that. Once again, though, this is Speak Up. I want to acknowledge that we are on the unceded territories of Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here gathering and living here since time immemorial, since a time before memory. And to start off this week's Speak Up, I thought I would play a track from a local Vancouver band by the name of Empanadas Ilegales. And I don't think your Spanish needs to be very good, as mine is not, to understand what that means. And this is a track from them called La Trifulca. Hope you enjoy. is Empanadas Ilegales with La Trifulca. It is my, you know, I'm manifesting right now. I really think Empanadas Ilegales should have a Studio 6 session here at CJSF. I think that would be absolutely amazing. For those who don't know, Studio 6 is sort of CJSF's version of a Tiny Desk concert where we get a local band to come in and do a live performance at the station, and then we put that up on our YouTube channel, CJSF Radio. There should be a, you know, slew of them incoming at some point in the near future, so stay tuned for that. But that would just be a dream. I would definitely attend that. And we are back again with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Hope you are all enjoying your Tuesday mornings. And we're going to keep going with a bit of talk content coming your way. This is a news story all the way from the East Coast, all the way in Toronto. And this is from Mia Johnson from Met Radio. And this piece is titled, "Toronto is seeing more lithium-ion battery fires. Experts say misuse and poor oversight are to blame." And that is something that I would like to learn more about. So I hope you all do too. So without further ado, Mia Johnson from Met Radio, take a listen.
This is Met Radio, 1280 AM, CJTM in downtown Toronto. I'm Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative. Toronto's seen a 38% jump in lithium-ion battery fires in recent years. 7 months into 2025, Toronto Fire Service say they've already responded to 43 battery fires just this year, according to the city's latest fire department report. While the bulk of fires are coming from micromobility devices, that's e-bikes or e-scooters, toys and cell phones are also at the root of this. Lithium-ion batteries power not only electric vehicles, but everyday devices like smartphones and laptops. While the city says these batteries are generally safe, they can become dangerous if damaged, tampered with, or improperly stored. But why the rapid increase? Related fires have been climbing since 2022 by 162%. To answer this question, Met Radio spoke to an expert who works with these batteries up close. He says fires like these can be fatal for first responders.
There's a lot of bad chemicals that will literally shred your respiratory system and kill you. You don't have a chance with some of this stuff.
Randy Narine is among those who have been pushing for stricter regulations on the transportation and storage of lithium batteries. He's a researcher with the Clean Energy Safety and Training Council of Canada, a nonprofit organization he founded himself. This is an organization dedicated to providing training and research to frontline workers and first responders in the clean energy sector. Narine is also an Ontario-based firefighter, serving in the force for well over 10 years. Toronto Fire launched a second public safety campaign on Monday to raise awareness about the growing risk around these fires. But Narine says public safety is more than just individual responsibility.
It has 100% to do with the way the battery's made and its capabilities and what it's made for.
Our station started by asking Narine how these batteries actually work. How do they fail and why do they catch fire? Here's our conversation. Randy, welcome to CJTM. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Is it possible that they get corrupted or faulty over time due to wear and tear?
A battery, to use it, back to the fundamentals, electricity is heat. So the transfer of electricity is transferring heat. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. When your breaker at home trips, it's not tripping because it detected too much electricity. It hit a certain temperature. So when you're charging a battery, it heats up the battery because there's heat coming into it. And the faster you're charging it, the more heat that's in it. That means the hotter the battery gets. A poorly made battery will fail because the heat is greater than the material's inside's ability to absorb it.
The city says the most common cause of many recent fires is those who have modified or tampered with the device. While Toronto Fire Service do have equipment and protocols for handling these fires, they can be very dangerous. Particularly in a city where there are high-rise buildings on every block, there's risk of structural collapse, Narine told our station.
But what is the difference between a regular fire and a lithium-ion related fire? Is there a difference?
Oh, yeah. I could tell you when I'm in a zone that's 290 degrees Celsius because I feel it. I feel like I'm on fire. It feels like you're standing next to a campfire with bare skin, but I'm in a snowsuit. I'm in my bunker gear. So that's what it feels like. I'm literally heating up inside and it is not pleasant. So that's how I can tell when it's getting too hot. We also have thermal imaging cameras that can tell the heat. Now, there's two things that happen at these lithium ion fires. They burn hotter, faster, and they spike to over 2000 degrees Celsius on cars and larger batteries than other devices. This phone will go at 600 degrees Celsius, right? So you're talking about heat that my gear is not able to handle. Its ability to light things on fire and spread a fire quickly is beyond anything that is conceivable within the fire service today. Structure collapse for concrete, commercial concrete, 600 degrees Celsius. That's when it starts failing and spalling. The commercial steel is 1200 degrees Celsius. A EV vehicle, like a Tesla, I've got a Tesla Model S, and if that thing caught on fire, it will burn in excess of 2000 degrees Celsius consistently. That structure cannot handle it. So can I really go in there and trust that that commercially built structure to the building code is going to sustain itself for me to be able to fight that fire without it coming down on me? What if it's a large commercial structure in Toronto, Ontario, where 20 stories up and they're not evacuating the building? You could potentially have structural collapse happening right in Toronto. These things are only going to become bigger and more concerning. Then there's the gases that come off of it. The VOCs that come off of it literally will shred your respiratory system. We have firefighters in Ontario that are currently on WSIB because of their exposure to these events.
Mia jumping in from the future again here. WSIB stands for Workplace Safety and Insurance Board. This provides benefits for work-related injuries and illnesses, including presumptive coverage for certain cancers for firefighters.
So, Randy, Toronto has seen a 38% increase in lithium-ion battery-related fires in the last 2 years, including a significant high-rise fire that led occupants and first responders suffering multiple injuries. And then since then, there's just been 43 related fires so far this year in Toronto. What do you put behind this escalation? Is it volume? Are they becoming more popular so people are buying them more? Or is it like carelessness? What is it?
So it's a combination of a few things. And I could say the low-hanging fruit on what's causing a lot of these problems is actually uncertified batteries. The second part to this is the fact that there are zero awareness around what battery abuse looks like. There's a lot of batteries in places and they're being used in manners that they weren't intended to be used. And that's what's causing these fires. All these e-bikes that are out there for rent right now are a major issue because they're a rental scooter. And what happens when you rent a car? You drive it like you stole it. So people are taking these things and abusing them because it's not theirs. What happens is you've got this flat platform and all the weight is being flexed on the center of what you're standing on. What you're standing on is the battery pack. So when you hear of these things happening, that's because there's all this abuse that's accumulated over time that is now causing the battery to fail, that then sets all the other batteries on fire. These e-scooters were never designed to be used in the way that kids are using them now. For example, before they put the battery in them, what did we used to do with the skateboards and the regular scooters? You skate them across curbs, you go down, you do tricks, you throw them up, you drop them down, you throw on these things all over the place. Well, there's a battery in it now, and people are doing the same thing. But what they don't realize is they're skating across the battery pack. They're crushing the battery pack. They're abusing this battery in ways it was never intended for. So when you look at use cases and when we create safety standards, it's made around a very specific thing. These standards are not made for dropping a car on a side railing or off a cliff, you know? So when you start having those things happening, that's when you see all these problems, and that's what's leading to a lot of it. You know, there's a number of things that are causing it, mm-hmm. but the number one cause is human error and the lack of education to the public. And because the public's not being educated behind this, the government's throwing all this money into this technology, but they're not putting any money into education.
Randy, I really appreciate you breaking this down and spreading awareness for how to stay safe and how people can reduce the risk around these fires. Thank you for coming on today.
I'm just barely touching the tip of the iceberg with you.
The City of Toronto is urging residents to follow a number of safety guidelines to prevent these fires. They're asking for people to keep batteries in sight while charging them, to never tamper or modify a battery, and to use only certified manufacturer-approved batteries and chargers. If any of the problem signs occur, like strange odors, discoloration, excessive heat, change in shape, leaking, or odd noises, they're asking residents to stop using the battery immediately and to contact the manufacturer. Old or damaged batteries can be disposed of at a city drop-off depot or at a community event day. Our theme music is by Robert Johnston. This is Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative. We're broadcasting from Met Radio, 1280 AM, CJTM in downtown Toronto.
Thank you once again to Mia Johnson from Met Radio for that actually quite interesting piece on lithium ion battery related fires in Toronto and how it's pretty significantly climbing for various reasons. Before we get into the next talk portion of the hour, I thought I would play another song from, that's right, Empanadas Ilegales. This is Chichara. Hope you enjoy. Let's get him to chart, guys.
Thank you.
Once again, that was Empanadas Ilegales with Chichara. And I want to thank them for coming out with such amazing music. Anyways, we are about 24 minutes into the hour, and I thought I would go on to the next talk segment, which is going to be a little looser. This is about the transit discussion event that I attended last night in the Marpole area of Vancouver. And it was definitely very interesting. Before the event started, I was under the impression that it was going to be more of a community discussion, and it certainly was, but sort of a community discussion from both sides of the argument for and against this proposed change, which would effectively reduce the street parking in Marpole and replace that with designated bus lanes. And obviously there were a lot of people for that and a lot of people against it. So I thought to introduce what I'm speaking about, I will play a very rough and uncut version of my brief interview with Dennis Agar of Movement YVR, the pro-transit organization of the Lower Mainland, for all of you.
Okay, just start recording. I guess I'm here with Dennis Agar of Movement YVR, and I wanted to just ask you what is going on today? What does this community event entail?
This is really exciting. You know, this represents kind of a collaboration with the Marpole Neighborhood House. They put a lot of work into this event to talk about the city's proposal to put bus lanes on Granville and generally to make transit better on Granville. And it's really meant to be an open dialogue. You know, there's going to be representatives from the Business Association here. Historically, they've been a bit opposed to bus lanes on Granville. They're really concerned about the parking in front of their businesses. You know, they're really sensitive to anything that might pose a threat to their livelihoods, which is understandable. And so this event is really to try and just get everyone into the same room and have a chat and see, you know, share each other's perspectives.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed in the posting for this event, one thing mentioning that, like, this is a plan that's been approved now for about a year, but there is a chance of it being overturned in some way. How would that happen?
Anything can always be overturned, I would say. It comes down to politics, right? That you put the right pressure on the right politician and things can be overturned. I've seen lots of transit projects be overturned at the last minute. You know, the Evergreen extension of the Millennium Line was going to be light rail until it was overturned. There was going to be three light rail lines in Surrey until it was overturned. And then it was, you know, SkyTrain. So anything can happen.
Mm-hmm. Is there a bit more optimism with, I guess, current changes on Vancouver City Council?
Well, I've got to give credit where it's due, that the ABC party that's been leading council since 2022 has always voted to support transit priority. Last year, Councillor Christine Boyle brought a motion to council to accelerate the bus lane efforts, to put out more bus lanes and deliver them more quickly. And every single ABC councillor voted yes for it. So I understand we might have a Councillor Kirby Young from ABC here tonight. And so I'm optimistic that all parties in Vancouver Council can get behind bus lanes, because they see that it's really our only way out of congestion. You know, like, our city's going to keep growing. We're not building freeways, which would entail tearing down thousands of homes and businesses. So really, transit is our only way to keep sustaining the growth that we have without demolishing things. I think all parties on council are supportive, but I will just say that you know, if they get thousands of emails opposed to something and no emails in support of it, that puts them in a really tough position to defend that project. And so our role is really to keep showing them constantly and permanently that transit has allies in this region.
And yeah, how do you, I guess, work against that argument that the loss of street parking is a overall net benefit for these business owners that may be opposed to the plan?
Well, there have been plenty of examples of streets where this kind of intervention has happened, where, you know, parking is removed in peak hours to make buses faster. So, yeah, there's been lots of examples of this, and it's been successful, right? The businesses have all survived, transit moves faster, and so it's just a matter of bringing those examples to light and kind of showing that, hey, you know, transit riders shop too. And yeah, I think just kind of coming to the table in a conciliatory kind of manner.
All right, what's the thing that you're looking forward to most with this event?
Just, you know, meeting a lot of the people in the equation, hearing individuals' concerns, hearing people's stories about, you know, having a hard time getting around. I'm always curious, like, you know, who chooses to spend their evening with us at events like this. Like, they must have a lot of passion. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they're bringing.
Mm-hmm. And can people expect to see more around the Lower Mainland throughout the summer?
I think this is kind of a one-off, just because there has been that opposition to the transit in this neighborhood. But you never know.